Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You think of me as a vigilante, fine. Ranging is my job. It's not saving the galaxy. It's helping people who have no one else to help them. It's hopeless and pointless and exhausting, and the only thing worse would be giving up.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Positively Trek Book Club. We have a special and rare occasion these days today, a new Star Trek book that we are talking about, a gorgeous new hardcover, Star Trek Picard Firewall by the esteemed David Mack. I can't handle this episode and all of its awesomeness alone, though. So with me to interview the author himself, David Mack, is Jesse Gender. Jesse, welcome back.
Yay, I'm glad to be here. I told you I would arrive like Captain America. Call me when you need me and I'll be here.
Awesome. I love it so much. Especially, and I mean, we'll get into it. I really wanted to talk with you about this novel in so many ways. And I'm so excited that, of course, with you, we get to talk to, as I mentioned, David Mack. David, welcome back to Positively Trek.
Thanks for having me back. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Like I said, it seems a little bit rare these days with the Star Trek novels and the release and stuff. And I guess just very briefly starting that out, I'm going to express a little frustration at how few Star Trek novels come out. And I know we'll never get back to where it was a few years ago with a novel a month, especially with the trade paperbacks and the higher price point. But I just do have to say this is such a wonderful oasis in this desert of Star Trek novels lately.
Well, hopefully this will not be the last of them. They will be a little bit more regular on the horizon starting about. It's only going to be a couple of months, I think, until we have Dayton Ward's Pliable Truths.
Which I'm very excited about.
Yeah. And then we're going to have Greg Cox's novel, I think Lost to Eternity. I believe that comes out in July. And I believe there's going to be a paperback compilation of the script for the audio drama No Man's Land. It's not a novelization.
That's what I was wondering. It wasn't clear when I saw the announcement.
Not a novelization. It is just a print publication of the original scripts for the audio drama. And then I believe there's a couple of other books that are in the pipeline that have been only informally announced. Una McCormick has a Strange New Worlds novel that showed up on Amazon. I believe it's called Asylum, and it had a September date. That may get pushed back from what I'm hearing rumors on the inside. That's not official. We don't know yet. Maybe she'll hit the deadline and it'll still come out in September, but it might be a little late. So just be prepared for that. But I know that there are books in the pipeline behind that, which I'm not allowed to mention because they haven't been formally announced, yada, yada, yada. But I know that there are good writers working on fun Star Trek book projects that are coming down the pike for 2025. And when you hear about them, you're going to be excited. I know I am.
Excellent. I mean, I know everyone just gets thrilled to know just that there are other books in the pipeline.
They are happening.
That's huge.
They
are
happening.
Awesome.
I'll tweet at Una and be like, Una, what are you doing? Get on it. Do it. I need the book now.
Trust me. She knows. She's under enough pressure. She doesn't need anybody yelling at her.
No, I am joking completely because adore Una. Give
her
a
little
love
her way. Say, hey, heard you're working on a book. You know, wish you all the best. Looking forward to seeing you. Be a bolster her spirits.
Yes, exactly. No,
absolutely.
Adore
bolster,
Una.
Don't badger.
So.
Well, we are here today, of course, to talk about one novel in particular, Star Trek Picard Firewall. First of all, I should mention at the top here, the first part of this discussion, we'll try and keep it a little spoiler free, and we'll give ample warning. We'll let everybody know. We don't have an actual alarm, but we'll sound the spoiler alarm or whatever.
Red alarm, red alarm.
There you go, exactly. So first of all, I'm curious, the origin of the novel. Where did the idea for a 7 backstory novel originate?
Well, the whole impetus to write a novel about the Fenris Rangers at all started when I was watching Picard season one back, I believe, in 2020. And I can't remember if it was episode 104, Absolute Candor, when they say it's a Fenris Rangers ship and they blow it up and they're 7 of 9. You owe me a ship, Picard. Or if it was 105, Stardust City Rag, where we learn more about Seven's backstory. And whatever, I think it may have actually been the end of 104. I saw the end of 104, I think, and there's Seven and whatever. And I immediately pick up my phone and I email my editor. Keep in mind, this is like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. My editor should not be awake. And I email my editor, I would like to write a Fenris Rangers novel, please. And about 15 minutes later, I get a reply from Margaret Clark saying, "You and everybody else." She said, "However, the producers have said hands off the Fenris Rangers, at least for now. They weren't sure at that time what they were going to do with them, whether or not they were going to play a significant part in the Picard series, whether they might want to do a spinoff, a movie. They had discussions, but they ended up not going anywhere." So about 2 years later, after Coda had come out, and I believe after I'd finished working on my next book after that, which was Harm's Way, which is my original series Vanguard crossover, I was talking with my editor and I said, "So what do you got? Need anything written? What do you need?" And my editor asked me, "Would you like to write a 7 of 9 novel?" I'm like, "Well, it depends. What kind of 7 of 9 novel?" Which of course is ridiculous. Of course I'm going to say yes, I'm being offered work. But my editor says, "Would you be interested in writing the story of how, when, where, and why 7 of 9 becomes a Fenris Ranger?" I said, "That sounds great. I will jump on that." So that was where it came from. It was simply an invitation from the editors. They said, "We got the green light from the folks at Secret Hideout. We would like to do this, and we'd like to have you do it." So I said, "Okay, I'm in." And that was what got the ball rolling. So I went back and I rewatched the season one episodes that were relevant. And then I pulled all the stuff from scripts and episodes from season two and season three of Picard. Any kind of dialogue reference at all to Fenris Rangers, especially by Seven. So I looked into all of that, and then I got my hands on the copy of the script for No Man's Land, and I read through that. And so I sort of amassed all this information, and from there began working on the story.
I remember, yeah, when those episodes in particular came out, there was a bunch of, you know, not obviously the groundswell of support for, you know, a Captain Pike series or the Star Trek Legacy thing, but I remember people saying, like, "Give us a mini series about the Fenris Rangers, 7 of 9's backstory, yada, yada, yada." And it kind of warms my heart to know that you were in that chorus as well, but like, aching to create that. That's pretty cool.
I saw it and I'm like, there's something very cool about this. Aside from the fact that the name is just kind of badass, you know, like reference to the Fenris Wolf, and you got Rangers, and all of a sudden I'm like, all right, so you kind of get the sense that these are some sort of weird badasses out on the edge of, like, you know, edge of no man's land out here, and they're getting into all kinds of trouble and they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff because that's what Rangers do. And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm into this. So yeah, I mean, the moment 7 of 9, you know, is identified as the Fenris Ranger, and just that badass line, "You owe me a ship, Picard." I'm like, in, yeah. I'm there. So didn't take much to persuade me.
They kind of fall into that same place as the Maquis, where they're like this like sort of Federation adjacent group made of like ex-Federation folks or former Federation citizens, it feels like. But then the show's ultimately not doing as much with them, leaving so much more for the novels to do. That's why I was thinking about that as I was reading the novels. Like, this feels like the modern Star Trek version of the Maquis, where there's like little pieces here.
Yeah, there are similarities. The Maquis were Federation citizens who were then basically abandoned, left to twist in the wind during a treaty negotiation with the Cardassians, where the Federation ceded a whole bunch of territory to Cardassian control and basically left these colonists high and dry under Cardassian authority. And effectively, they lost their Federation citizenship because their colonies went from being Federation protectorates to being Cardassian protectorates. And so you had a whole bunch of former Federation citizens who were pretty ticked off about, you know, a treaty that was made without their consent, without their input, suddenly affects their lives this profoundly, strips them of basic citizenship, protections, legal recourse, and leaves them under the control of an authoritarian regime. So they were understandably ticked off, and that's the sort of thing that will start a rebellion, a resistance, a Maquis uprising. The Fenris Rangers, however, something different. They were not necessarily Federation citizens. They might be Federation citizens. They might be citizens of other powers, neighboring powers, unaligned planets. What we got in Picard was an organization that over decades has become kind of like a bunch of roving gangs of, you know, kind of Robin Hood and his men, but in space. A whole bunch of Robin Hood gangs, each patrolling their own kind of sector of space and doing things their own way. And as they said, you know, I believe in No Man's Land, by that point, the Fenris Rangers have no central command. They have no official uniform. There's no hierarchy left. They're just sort of coasting on the name and the reputation by that point. But what I decided to do is I was coming in, and since I'm doing an origin story, and the most logical point at which to make that happen was about 20 years before Picard, I realized the Fenris Rangers could have been a very different organization at the time Seven joins. She might have joined them just as things are beginning to go to hell. The organization has only just recently lost its actual legitimacy, its sort of charter with several worlds that gave it its legal authority. So now it's just sort of left out there. You know, it is what it was, but now it doesn't really answer to anybody. And it's trying to carry on business as usual, but the wheels are starting to come off. The budget is getting frayed. The place is starting to fall apart. People don't really know who's in charge. Discipline is beginning to sort of crumble. You're beginning to see, you know, this is an organization that is eventually just going to be like the Roman Empire. It's going to come down eventually. And someday all that's going to be left is the name. But that's not this day. This day, there's still a bit of organization. There's still a bit of pride. There's still the official Fenris Rangers jacket. You know, there's still some sense of, you know, leadership. Sure, unity. There's a sense of mission. Mm-hmm. They've maybe lost a little bit of their sense of pride, but Seven kind of gives it back to them.
Mm-hmm. What I, kind of something you said there that I found fascinating, without getting too spoilery, but it is present in the beginning of the novel, is how much of a lot of the impetus for this story comes out of just like the budget, not just with the Fenris Rangers, but with our villain character as well. It reminded me a lot of kind of Star Wars Andor with the Eldani heist, and just like how much of it's just like how much of this is just trying to get enough money to be able to keep doing things is just a major like through line throughout the whole book, which I found to be fascinating, especially in a Star Trek novel.
It's funny, you're the second person I've heard compare the book to Andor.
Mm.
And although that wasn't a conscious intent on my part when I was writing it, I did love the Andor series, and I thought it was one of the best things the Star Wars franchise has done in its sort of TV format. So I'm very flattered that anybody would compare my book to Andor in a favorable way. So yeah, I think, I mean, maybe there was an unconscious influence. Maybe I took the parts of that I liked and simply transplanted them.
Yeah, no, I found that it's just one of those things like Tony Gilroy was talking about with Andor. It's just like, oh, I just wanted to be interested in like how they balanced the budget, and he compared it to like Stalin and Lenin and like the Russian Revolution as well. So I was thinking about that as I was reading this book. It's just the same thing where it's just so much of this is just so many different groups just being like, how are we going to be able to pay to be able to get enough resources for the next day or to get the things that we need?
How do we keep our ships flying? Where do we get fuel? We keep losing ships. How do we buy more? Well, they've got our shipment of 20 new starfighters, but they won't give them to us because we didn't pay them for the last batch.
Mm-hmm.
These things aren't free. They don't grow on trees. Sooner or later, somebody somewhere has to pay for something. There's got to be some measure somewhere where somebody goes, and what's in it for me?
Another thing, just speaking of Star Wars, and I also loved Andor so much, definitely see those parallels there. I had another thought while I was reading this as well, and you kind of are able to do something in this novel that we don't see a lot of in Star Trek, and that's show us Federation or Star Trek worlds, not necessarily Federation worlds, mm-hmm. that are populated by just a whole bunch of different species all kind of living together. In Star Trek, it always seems to be very segregated by planet, with the exception of maybe Earth sometimes. But
even Earth is very human heavy, except for the Starfleet.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you see like more Vulcans. You'll catch the occasional Rigelian or Andorian walking around on Earth, but yeah, it's very much it's humans' home. I mean, so you'd expect that. Just like you go to Vulcan, you expect to mostly see Vulcans, but there's going to be humans about. You'll see an Andorian tourist or something. But yeah, I had this sort of notion of out on the fringes of Federation space, like maybe when you're just outside and now you're in unaligned space, you're in, you know, territories that are just their own star system and they don't really answer to anybody. I had this image of, you know, Blade Runner style cities where alien members of different species come together and just live in these polyglot societies. And I guess part of that is that, you know, I've lived in New York City now for 36, coming up on 37 years. So I have a very urban mindset. I am used to the notion of individuals of very different backgrounds, different languages, different cultures, different beliefs, different cuisine styles, all living piled on top of each other and somehow making it work and learning to get along and share the space. And you know, occasionally you drive each other a little crazy, but for the most part, people learn how to respect their neighbor's space. They learn how to get along. They learn how to navigate social interactions with people who are not like them without basically infuriating them. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if it's possible for humans to do it amongst ourselves, maybe it's possible for a variety of alien species, members of different species, to come together and, you know, live in some sort of huge futuristic city.
It reminds me kind of what, jumping off of that, I was listening to a podcast, the Women at War podcast, and they were talking about Empire in Star Trek and sort of like how the Federation still, while it has a lot of these ideas of egalitarianism and trying to be very like we're welcoming society, they still, by the very nature of them being just a large presence, kind of force people that are around them, even if they're not directly under Federation control, to have to be influenced by the Federation and trade with the Federation or be reliant on the Federation. And you kind of bring that in here where it's kind of an inciting prior to the start of the novel, in the backstory, like one of the inciting incidents of why the Fenris Rangers are so necessary and yet are viewed as vigilantes is just the destabilization of the region when the Federation is sort of pulled out and left to go help with the Romulan supernova. So I was curious, like, your thinking on how to, you were building that sort of political backdrop for this.
Well, that was one of the things I talked about early on with my editor and also with Kirsten Beyer, who, in addition to being a co-creator of the TV series Star Trek Picard, acts as the liaison between Secret Hideout, the entity that produces Star Trek on TV, and Simon & Schuster, the entity that produces Star Trek books. And I believe she also acts in this capacity with the comic book folks over at IDW and elsewhere. So we were just, you know, talking about, you know, what were going to be the factors that were going to drive the Fenris Rangers, drive the villain. How did we want to incorporate the Romulan story? Because we have to address it based on the time period and when things started to happen on Romulus. They were going to be there. So we decided to, rather than just, you know, paper over it or ignore it, we decided to fold it into the story to make it part of what the narrative is about. Yeah, we talked about the fact that, you know, there are all these NGOs, non-governmental organizations, which very often have influx of funding that comes from a national source, like, say, the United States or the United Federation of Planets, but the organization itself is not an official organization of that government. It's a privately run, non-profit sort of a thing, and it takes the funding it gets, and it goes places, and it tries to do good things and help people. The thing is, when you leave a lot of your charitable work to NGOs, and you don't actually do most of it yourself hands-on, if something happens and those NGOs have to get pulled out, there's very little to take their place. And if a culture, a society, a city, a planet has become dependent on the support they get from those NGOs, and one morning they wake up and the NGOs have all left because they all had to go to Romulus, now you're screwed. What if that NGO was the source of your medicine? What if they were the ones who had all the industrial replicators and you needed them to fabricate stuff and keep your cities running? What if, you know, they were the ones who had the portable fusion generators that actually powered your settlements? What if they were the ones who provided your clean water? Suddenly, they're gone and you're screwed and you don't have ships. So you're not going anywhere, at least not quickly. So we basically talked about the fact that although the Federation, especially the core worlds, are very well supplied, they're very well financed, they're well established, they've been around for centuries, they've got their stuff mostly worked out, and that's great for them, but not everybody lives that way. Not everybody has that privilege. Some people who are maybe, let's say, not fully in the Federation, haven't qualified, or maybe they're in politically unstable regions, and so they can't get in even if they'd want to, they don't have the luxury of this cashless economy of what's the word I'm looking for? Abundance. They have this, you know, an economy of abundance. It's not an economy of scarcity. These planets still operate on economy of scarcity. That is, they're using a scarcity model, which is what we all currently live on today, because energy is finite, resources are finite, water is finite. And at some point, conflict arises over who has the right to it, who controls it, who gets to decide who gets it, et cetera, et cetera. So on worlds where they don't have that luxury of saying it's all going to be okay because we have antimatter power generation and we have replicators and this and that, the ones that don't have that, they're like, and, you know, we'd love to, you know, help out the people on the street, but we're starving ourselves. What are we supposed to do? You know, we'd love to help these people, but we can't, we don't have enough power to turn on the lights. What do you want us to do? And you leave these people in the lurch, a couple of things are going to happen. They're either going to turn to bad actors to bail them out, or they're going to become victims of bad actors who are working with somebody else, or they're just going to fall apart, or they're going to become bad actors themselves. So we basically talked a lot about, you know, what is it like for the Federation when, you know, so it's great to have Utopia, but if you live next door to Utopia and you don't have a key and you can't get in, what's life like then? And what happens if you're relying on Utopia to help bail you out? And one day Utopia says, yeah, somebody needs more than you. So good luck. And they're gone. What happens? And so we talked about the idea of a vacuum, not just of power, but of goodwill, a vacuum of authority, of information, where there's just suddenly this dead zone where nobody knows who's in charge. Nobody knows who's doing what. Nobody knows who to turn to. Nobody knows who's going to fix anything. And this is where the Fenris Rangers come in. They're the ones who are struggling to hold the Kyrus sector in particular together at a moment where all the resources that were holding it together have vanished. And governments collapsed. And once those governments collapsed, those were the governments with whom the Rangers had legal agreements that made them the legal interstellar patrol, you know, fugitive capture, shipping control, whatever. All their authority to do all these various functions came from having agreements with all the governments on these star systems in the Kyrus sector. And as those governments fall apart, well, you still have the Fenris Rangers, but they don't answer to anyone anymore. And so you have a vacuum. And it creates confusion. It creates questions of who has jurisdiction. Can you help somebody? Well, Starfleet would love to help, but unfortunately, they've got these very strict rules of engagement, as Captain Solok has to explain to Seven. The problem is jurisdictional. You, as a Fenris Ranger, don't have the authority to speak for the people of, let's say, the planet Soroya 4. You are not their elected representative. You're not their elected leader. You are not their government. I cannot accept your word that I have to respond to a planetary distress call because it's not your planet. Because it's not your planet, you can't authorize me to come in. If you can't authorize me to come in, I can't go in there because that's not Federation territory. I don't have jurisdiction there. I can't go there unless there's a legally recognized governmental entity that's saying, yes, please come help us. Pen pals aside, it's not as easy as Sarjanka sends out a message and asks Data for help, and Picard's heart melts, and so he has to go save the little girl. Technically, no. If there's no legal government authorizing you to come into their territory, you're not going to go there. And so this is the problem that has spread, and this is where the Fenris Rangers come in. They say, well, we're not going to wait on technicalities, paperwork, contracts, treaties. That's all nice, high and mighty, highfalutin talk. But guess what? Every day you're waiting on someone to negotiate a new treaty or someone to set up a new government, people are dying. They're dying of thirst. They're dying of hunger. They're being killed in genocidal acts by warlords. And nobody's doing a damn thing about it. Well, we're going to do something about it. And if you don't like it, too bad. We're here. You're not. You want to get involved? Come on in. Until then, go to hell. We're going to get to work.
And that's why I like the Fenris Rangers a lot, especially as you hit them.
They're badass. They're like, screw you. We're not waiting. We're getting involved.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's done a really good job of kind of setting up the world that we're coming into, or the universe that we're coming into with this book. So I'm going to go ahead and just say spoiler alert here for the actual story.
Here there'll be spoilers.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you see there is the beginning of the world that we're going to live in as of the Picard series. The deterioration starts around 2380, 2381. That's when the whole Romulan crisis begins. That's when the shift of resources starts. This exacerbates a lot of the xenophobia that's going on Earth, particularly towards the Borg. After they got their asses handed to them in 2373, which is First Contact, and, you know, 2378, Seven comes back with Voyager expecting to be welcomed with open arms, and she finds a culture that hates the Borg and fears the Borg and is not willing to welcome her at all. And so she's not welcome. She's persona non grata on Earth. And then the whole situation with Romulus begins, and now resources are spread thin, and this just begins to exacerbate that sense of growing desire for isolationism within the Federation. It's the sort of thing that gives rise to, as we saw in Picard, you know, when the disaster happens on Mars and the synths are blamed for it, and suddenly they're willing to just pass this draconian anti-artificial intelligence law, banning synthetic intelligence. And it's like, how do you reconcile that with Federation values? Mm-hmm. It's like, where did this reactionary, protectionist, isolationist, xenophobic crap come from? Well, it's been building for a while. It was the Borg.
Since the Dominion War, the Borg.
Stretched resources, and then Mars was just the final, straw, where somebody clearly, it seems like the Tal Shiar, were clearly looking to minimize the Federation's impact on local space. They're like, we got to make these people pull inward and get them out of our face. So I'm pretty sure that was the Tal Shiar who did that on Mars. But we see the beginnings. That's the world that's coming. We know that that's what's 20 years in the future for, for Seven and everybody else. This is when the groundwork for that really starts to fall into place, and we start to see the dominoes begin to topple.
And that's where I really liked you setting this novel up, especially for Seven of Nine. And one of the things, too, that I wanted to talk to you about, because you had it very clearly at the beginning of the novel, was, Seven of Nine has been ostracized within the Federation as an ex-Borg. And it was something, too, that I really loved in Star Trek Picard Season 1 with Jonathan Del Arco and Hugh and the XBs on the artifact, where it was this very clear utilization of ex-Borg for a queer metaphor, not necessarily just as a sexuality metaphor, but just people who are shoved aside in our society based on just something that they can't control and stigmatization towards them. And then you literally linked it with 7 of 9 in this novel in a sequence that I really loved with her going to a queer club and sort of like finding herself on these like weird, like small, communities, both in the like queer club, but also in the communities that she finds, like the labor communities that she's in. So I'm curious, like, your thinking in terms of like linking all those things together, and obviously setting up sort of the bisexuality that we see Seven showcasing in Picard proper as well.
Well, as you point out, it was obviously a very deliberate choice. It's not like I did it by accident. Picard, the series, established around the end of season one clearly that Seven was not only bisexual, but that by that point in her life, she was very comfortable with her bisexuality. She was able to be out. She was a far more emotional individual. She had lost a lot of that stilted, sort of almost robotic quality that she had when we first met her on Voyager. All of that was gone. We met a very different incarnation of Seven 20 years down the line. So I said, okay, it seems to me like what I'm tackling here is a story of this period of transition, this liminal period in Seven's life, when she goes from being the woman we saw in Voyager, who was very stilted, very closed off, closed off from her own emotions, from her sense of empathy for other people, just sort of beginning to awaken to it. And she's also been re-socialized into humanity in this very cis heteronormative environment on Voyager. And so she hasn't really had much of a chance to figure out for herself who she is. Everything she's learned about who she is has been in the context of her Voyager shipmates and their relationships with her and their expectations of her. And so she's trying to live up to those expectations that have been projected onto her because she doesn't have anything else at that point. But then when she gets to Earth and she's been promised, you know, Earth is a paradise and everybody gets along and everybody is welcome and this and that, and won't it be wonderful? And she gets there and her Aunt Irene flinches when she hugs her because she's got Borg implants and they're cold when they touch her face. And Aunt Irene won't call her Seven of Nine because, you know, and suddenly you got Aunt Irene dead naming her and calling her Annika Hansen, no matter how many times she tries to explain this. My name is Seven of Nine. And Aunt Irene just won't, just can't get her brain around it, won't accept it, won't respect it. And then, you know, one day, she, you know, Seven wakes up and she's living outside of Cape Town, South Africa, and someone has painted Die Borg Bitch on the front of her house. And the local cops aren't exactly all that interested in investigating, and they seem maybe to not care. And this is the point where she realizes, I can't live here. I am never going to be welcome here. I am never going to be my best self here. I can't be the best version of myself living somewhere I know I'm hated, where everybody seems to have, you know, not just hidden hostility toward me, but now naked, open hostility toward me. And the authorities show no damn interest in protecting me at all. I got to get the hell out of this place. Mm-hmm. She's learned, you know, I could take any one of them in a fight, but you don't win against an angry mob. She's learned to be afraid. She's learned, you know, you got to be careful when you leave the house. You got to cover the things that make you visibly different if you can. Yeah. Because otherwise people get scared. And as they said in Mission, in Men in Black, you know, people are smart. No, a person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, violent animals. Yeah. She goes out, as you said, she goes out to find her existence. And I realized once I sort of figured out the shape of the story that what I was writing was a Bildungsroman, a coming of age story. And for Seven, it's not just a coming of age story in terms of her values aligning with those of the Fenris Rangers. It's also a queer coming of age story in that I feel like for many adults, many folks, they didn't really have a chance to figure out who they really were until you get out in the world on your own, separate from your parents. And it's only then when you get to be alone with yourself that you really have that opportunity to say, who am I really? What is it I really want? What am I actually attracted to? Who do I want to be? What do I believe in? You don't even have a chance to ask yourself these questions sometimes until you've got the space to think, which is what she needs. So she's got to leave home. Really, it's a story about Seven leaving home, finding herself. And at first, she just, you know, is sort of barely living beyond self-harm. She finds a job that feels like working in a Borg cube. She's having these one-night stands where she's trying to find connection, but all she's finding is isolation, alienation, ennui. You know, she's not connecting with people. She realizes at some point that people are using her. And she didn't even realize she was getting used. And so she sort of has to go through this whole hard learning process because her childhood was taken away from her. Her adolescence got taken away from her. Her young adulthood got taken away from her, all by the Borg. And so she's starting over. She's 32 years old, but she might as well be 17 or 15 and leaving home and, you know, going out alone into the galaxy for all the socialization she's had. And she's got to figure this out. She's going out into a community where she doesn't know how to flirt. It's for her. It's like everybody's speaking a language that nobody ever taught her. And she's trying to figure it out, but it's like she's living in an alien culture that she just doesn't get. And so it's about her sort of finding her way, finding her identity, and eventually recreating the found family that she really loved, which was the one on Voyager. She doesn't even realize she's doing it until it's done. You know, she finds Harper, and so instead of the surrogate mother figure of Janeway, she now finds a surrogate father in Harper. she goes and sort of, you know, finds herself comfortable among the Fenris Rangers, but she doesn't know why. It's like, well, there's the brash half Cardassian woman who's sort of, you know, curt with everybody. Gee, sound a little like B'Elanna. You've got your hotshot pilot, Lucan Sagasta, who loves to flirt and talk a good game. Gee, does that sound at all like Tom Paris? And Jaylen Parr, the Bajoran Ranger who gets, you know, teamed up with someone else, who's kind of, you know, nice and quiet, self-effacing, very competent, very brave, but underrated, sound a little like Harry Kim, and so on. And she realizes at some point, she has to rebuild the found family. And that's what she finds. She finds the family she needs. And they're the ones who take her in at the moment she needs somebody to take her in. They're the ones who accept her after her first found family just has scattered to the wind. And so this is what she finds. And, you know, she recreates that family.
And something you touched upon there, too, is I really loved the position of Janeway throughout the novel as like the surrogate mother figure who is trying both to be like, why aren't you following the path that I had laid out for you that I thought you were always going to follow, and learning to be able to accept Seven's own choices on her own terms and still seeing her as family and acknowledging that, which I thought was a really one of my favorite scenes in the book is when at the end of the near the end of it, where she's talking with the I forget who it was, the person back at Starfleet who's like, well, we can't accept Seven, you know, you gotta bring her in or whatever. And then,
oh, that's Kima Geist, the director of the Federation Security Agency.
Exactly. And there's just that back and forth between the two of them where Janeway's like, well, I will stand up for my family, like just this quick back and forth between the two of them. I found both, it was a little bit comical because I could just totally see Janeway having that sort of like, yeah, the stance, but it was also a really wonderful moment of Janeway standing up for Seven regardless of her own feelings about Seven's choices, which I thought was really a beautiful moment for her character.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's another classic element of the coming of age story. Mm-hmm. You've got the conflict between child and parent, where, as you say, you know, Janeway had sort of laid out this vision for what she thought was the best way forward for Seven, what she wanted for Seven, and honestly, what she thought Seven wanted for herself, and that's what she was trying to fight for at the beginning of the book. She thought that what Seven wanted and what was best for her would be for Seven to get into Starfleet for, you know, to have a commission, or failing that, to at least go to the academy and get in the hard way. And Starfleet was just like saying, no, you don't understand. You've got a discipline problem here. She's got a record of violence against your crew. She hijacked your ship at least twice. We've got records of assaults on officers. And then we've got the whole identity problem where she's identifying with the Borg collective with her name, and she won't take back her Federation citizenship. We can't give her citizenship if she won't take back her name. She's rejecting her Federation ID.
Which I found that was a great point, by the way. I love that like legal like identification concept. That was really cool.
By contrast, people say, well, why did Icheb get in when she didn't? Well, first of all, look at his name. Icheb takes back his non-Borg designation. And during his time aboard Voyager, he was a model officer and model cadet. He did everything that was asked of him. He disobeyed never. He was insubordinate never. He was an overachiever from the very beginning. He was personable. He was likable. He was amenable. He was flexible. He basically is the model ex-Borg. If anybody is going to be granted dispensation by Starfleet, it's Icheb. Icheb is the guy they're looking for. Seven is a discipline problem. She is exactly what they don't want. She scares the living shit out of them because she's a rebel. She's a rogue. She acts on her own conscience and doesn't really give much of a damn about regulations. Of course they don't want her. But this creates this problem where, you know, but because Seven has been programmed by her relationship with Janeway to think that that's what she wants, it's, again, this is also a classic device in storytelling. The character at the beginning of a story wants something. This is what they want. What they discover over the course of the story is that what they wanted is not actually what they needed. Seven starts the story thinking, you know, what she wants is a place in Starfleet. She wants a commission, a place at the academy. She wants to be in Starfleet. That's not what she needs. What she discovers she needs is to find a place where she is accepted for who she is, loved for who she is, where she can feel useful, where she can feel like she's living a life where she makes a difference and doesn't have to compromise her morals or her sense of what is right and what is wrong. She wants to be able to act on her conscience in her own sort of time frame and her own idiom. And at that age, at that point in her life, Starfleet is not it. Starfleet doesn't want her, and what she learns once she gets involved with the Fenris Rangers is maybe she doesn't really want Starfleet. Maybe Starfleet wasn't such a great fit. And the more time she spends with the Rangers and she starts to picture her future, she sees herself in a Fenris Rangers jacket, you know, out on the frontier with her own ship. And she's thinking, you know, that's not bad. Fenris Ranger, lone wolf with my own sort of Starfire 500 out here. Yeah, that's a good life. That's a life I could be proud of. And the problem is that Janeway looks at this and says, you want to become a vigilante? You want to be part of an organization that doesn't have legitimacy anymore? And this is the big problem. It's Seven is trying to explain to her, they are not what you think they are. You have been basically given a whole lot of Federation and Starfleet propaganda that discredits the Fenris Rangers, but you don't see any of the good that they're doing. You only see the legal technicalities of how they operate and the lack of paperwork or whatever. That's what you see. What you don't see is the work they actually do on the ground. And Janeway's trying to say, yes, you may feel that way now, but this is an organization that's going to become more disjointed over time. This lack of oversight is going to lead to this and this and this. And it just, as you say, it comes to a head finally where Janeway, you know, when Seven says, this is my decision, it's what I'm doing. And Janeway says, well, I just can't condone it. And that's when Seven breaks through to Janeway was saying, I don't need you to condone it. I need you to trust me. And that's when the switch flips for Janeway and she understands, yes, Seven, I do trust you. You're right. I may not love the Fenris Rangers, but I do trust you. And that's the point where parent and child have now reached equality, where, you know, they can now regard each other both as adults. They're both equals. They may not have arrived at the same conclusion, but they can respect each other's judgment and each other's point of view without having to vilify each other. And they can even, by Seven showing how Starfleet and the Rangers can work together in the story's climax, she sets the stage for future cooperation and rapprochement. And so you have that going on, and then you finally just have the whole notion of just being able to, you know, address each other by their first names. Like when Janeway finally says, you can call me Catherine. That's the moment when they are now adults, they are now equals, and they can just be friends.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. A special thank you to our Constitution class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Mirren, and Paul D. Kinnear. To help out with the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek, where for a small monthly donation, you can get early access to ad-free episodes, shoutouts, exclusive content, associate producer credits, and more. Thank you so much for listening, and live long and prosper. That evolution over the course of this novel and her coming to that place, both of them coming to that place, is just one of the most beautiful things in this story. And that kind of shedding the trappings of her old life on Voyager and those expectations and stuff was something that I found really fascinating. And when you see Seven in Picard, that's what you start to wonder, right? Like, how do you go from there to there? So many little things that you did in this story, I really appreciate. Like for example, the ditching of the Chakotay relationship, which it wasn't summarily mocked and dismissed, which this is why I'm not a writer, because I probably would have mocked that relationship and given it a kick out the airlock.
I mean, I had my issues with the relationship, most of the fact that he's the ship's first officer. And even though she's not officially a member of Starfleet, she occupies a place in the crew, in the upper echelon of the crew. And him having a relationship with her, given the fact that she's only recently out of assimilation it just, it felt icky to me. It felt like a power imbalance existed in their relationship, where he had a lot of power, a lot of agency, and just a lot of experience as an older man. And here he's suddenly embarking on this sexual and romantic relationship with Seven, who is not yet fully re-socialized. I mean, she's barely begun to figure out this level of social interaction, and he's just trying to move it way too fast, I mean, in my opinion. But yeah, like, what I figured out was, you know, aside from everything else, I said, if we're looking for the reason that they would split, an honest reason that would, you know, preclude them actually being able to go any further forward, it's when she comes home and Starfleet says, well, first of all, we can't give you citizenship. Second, no, we're not going to give you a commission. Third, we're not letting you in the academy. You are dangerous. You are a persona non grata. We don't want you on the grounds of Starfleet Command. We don't want you at the academy, yada, yada, yada. At the same time, Chakotay gets promoted to captain and put in charge of the Protostar project, a project so damn secret, he can't even tell the name of the project. He can't even say the word Protostar. He can't tell her the name of the project. What does that do to a relationship? Well, it basically builds this reservoir of envy, of anger, resentment. He suddenly, the Maquis, who violently rebelled against the Federation and Starfleet, suddenly now he gets a captaincy. He's welcomed back with open arms, despite everything he did.
Starfleet's golden boy now.
And he's golden boy, and he gets handed the freaking Protostar, and he gets handed command of a top secret new project, this very high profile thing, and she can't go anywhere near it. She's given nothing. She's pariah. That's the sort of thing that will just destroy a relationship, especially if you've got someone like Seven, who again is still new to coping with human emotions, especially really toxic ones like envy, jealousy, anger, resentment, just the fury of being excluded, of facing persecution, you know, obvious racism, and being powerless to do anything about it while watching him get rewarded. As she says, you know, I self-sabotaged that relationship. I was so full of envy. I was so full of anger. I just destroyed it. There was no way. I couldn't deal with him getting everything and me getting nothing. And I just felt like that was probably a very realistic explanation for what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it fits perfectly, and it ties in Prodigy pretty nicely in a nice subtle way, which was kind of fun to catch.
That plus we have the Dauntless crew.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I was about to say that was even more fun when we got to that point in the series and the novel. And I was like, oh, hey, look, it's my favorite Tellarite doctor. I was very excited about that.
Hey, we know them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was funny when I read at the beginning in the based on things, and you know, I always read through everything, and I saw based on Star Trek Prodigy at the end there. I was like, oh. And then we got to the, you know, mention of Chakotay and the Protostar. I was like, oh, okay, I guess that was it. That's
that was
cool.
It. And then, ta-da!
And then, mm-hmm. Imagine my surprise, the Dauntless and Noom and
Tysis,
and even a little mention of Essentia there.
Yep, which was like, she was there. She was there. Of course, and then, of course, there's the fun little Easter egg of Second Officer Benson, named for Shauna Benson, who was one of the writers on Prodigy.
Oh, nice.
Of course,
was
right.
Just Julie. Yeah. Basically, I named a character after Julie in my TOS Vanguard crossover novel, Harm's Way, which came out back in, I think, 22. And you can't name a character after one sister in a writing pair and then not do one the other sister, because this is how sibling rivalries begin and blood spilled on the floor, and it's never...
There's that resentment, that envy.
You see what I'm saying? So
exactly.
I created a character for Julie, so I had to make one for Shauna. You know, Julie got to fly the Enterprise. Shauna gets to pull a phaser and arrest a Romulan hitman. So, you know, it kind of balances out.
It's about equal.
It's a wash.
I'm curious too what your thinking was for the villain of this, because again, I kind of alluded to this in the spoiler-free section, but his whole intention really is just to make money. He just extort everybody, squeeze everybody, just so he can make money as fast as possible to buy a warship, then he can solidify his power, which I thought was a really interesting
Kogish.
Place for a character. Yeah, Kogish, yeah.
Kogish, the Antican warlord. Yeah, he kind of lies to himself pretty easily. He tells himself that he's doing this so that he can bring stability to the region, so that he can, you know, quell dissent and have, you know, and maintain power and order and put an end to all this chaos. No. He's lying to himself. He's just a greedy bastard who loves power, and he's a sadist. He's a freaking monster. He just doesn't want to see himself as a monster. This is a guy who, by this point, has probably killed somewhere in the neighborhood of close to 1 million people over the past year or two, you know, in genocidal events, one of which Seven has to see, you know, up close and personal. There's nothing noble about his intention. He's petty. He's selfish. He's arrogant. And he's, you know, a self-pitying, you know, idiot, because when things don't go his way, he's like, you three are the reason I can't have nice things. You know, when something goes wrong, oh, it's not my fault. It's Aristu Mardani's fault. You got me into this. You know, it's your fault. You gave me bad intelligence. You promised me this would be handled. Yeah, because you didn't screw up at all. Right. And then, of course, you've got the other villain, the other half of this villain pie, Aristu Mardani, also known as Errol Tazgul, who may or may not be a rogue Federation security agency spy master. Is he actually rogue? Or is that just their story so that if he gets caught, he has, you know, they have plausible deniability and they can say, oh, we're not with him. Yeah, we had nothing to do with that. He embezzled the money. It's not our fault. We didn't do it. Are they telling the truth? Are they lying? Well, we may never know. There's really no way to be sure. All we know is to maintain appearances, they did arrest him and that son of a bitch is going to jail.
It's always an individual's fault, never the system's fault.
That's right. It's never the system. The system can't possibly be at fault.
No,
that's
no.
Just crazy talk.
Especially in a queer story.
God, yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I found that to be a really I loved that depiction of the villain is just, again, going back to that same sort of like, it's all about the money. It's all about just trying to solidify power, trying to get there first, too, which was a big thing throughout of it. Just like, we need to be able to get this first before anyone else does, or else they'll be able to get the power. The Fenris Rangers will be able to solidify their hold on the region. So that's that, speaking again to that destabilization of the region you're talking to.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit about Seven of Nine's new relationship, Ellery Cade, this Trill Fenris Ranger that she becomes involved with over the course of the novel.
First great love of her life.
Yeah, I loved the evolution of that relationship. And I was wondering if there was anything that kind of inspired that or kind of informed your depiction of them on this journey, I guess.
I guess what I was thinking about partly was I knew I wanted to acknowledge that there was a shift in Seven's sexuality between what we saw in Voyager and the person we knew in Picard. And I figured if ever there was going to be a period in her life when this is something she was going to explore, it's going to be that moment when she's first out on her own. It's going to be that moment when she's staking a claim to her own life, rebuilding her identity from the ground up and saying to herself, this is who I am. This is what I believe to be true about me. I've got to find my truth and live it. This is going to be part of it. And I didn't want to shy away from it. I didn't want to minimize it. I didn't want to just say, well, obviously that happens at some point after this story, but before Picard, because I felt like, A, that'd be a massive cop-out. And B, I felt like it would be a missed opportunity to tell a beautiful love story, which is also very often a key component in a coming of age story. Coming of age is very, very often contains the first great romance of a character's life. So I knew I wanted it to be a woman that she would meet. I figured it made the most sense for that woman to be a Fenris Ranger. And so I started to think about the details of it and the personality of it. And, in my mind, I was picturing Jessica Henwick, Colleen Wing from the Iron Fist series, among other things. I guess the one thing that I was sort of conscious of as I began to dig into that and I was planning the story at the outline stage was I'm highly cognizant of the fact that I am a cishet middle-aged white guy trying to write a story about a woman, Seven of Nine, who is an icon of both the queer and trans communities, having a romance storyline with another woman. And I'm like, there are so many ways I can get this wrong. Let's be really careful about this. So talk to some of my friends who were queer. I said, you know, what are the mistakes that straight white guys always make when they try to write these stories? What are the pitfalls? And, you know, it's like, they said, well, obviously, you know, bury your gaze, look out for that plot line. It's always something, you know, there's going to be the tragic event in the character's life. And you just say, well, we'll kill off the love interest. yeah, why is it always the gay love interest that dies? I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. so bury your gaze. Pitfall number one. What's another one? They said, well, this isn't specific to your story, but very often there's a really cool, fun character of color, like a supporting character of some kind, and they tend to be the one who gets blown away in the middle of the book to show the situation's really serious. We hate that. I went, okay, so don't kill the cool, interesting character of color in the middle of the book. What else? And we just sort of went through the checklist of, you know, these are the typical mistakes that straight writers will make while trying to tackle these stories. And the third and most important, which, you know, thankfully I'm self-aware enough that even I was aware of this, the risk of trying to tell a story like this and tainting it with the male gaze. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, the issue really here is to keep in mind at all times that what I am writing is a love story. I am writing a story about these two people, these two individuals who each have had defective relationships up to this point in their life. And for some reason, when the two of them meet, there's going to be this magical moment of connection that neither can define, but both feel. They're going to fall for each other. They're going to love each other very purely, very powerfully. They're going to be there for each other. They're going to defend each other. And most importantly, they're going to still be together at the end of the story. I'm not going to break them up. I'm not going to take away their happiness. And there's going to be no barrier gaze. Now, we know from Picard that the relationship can't last forever. First great love of your life rarely does. Someday, yes, for some reason, at some point, that relationship will end. And it probably ends between 2381 and 86, the framing sequence of the book, because she's clearly not with Ellery anymore by that point. There may be a story in that, but that is not the story I came here to tell. I came here to tell the story of two good people who fall in love. So I'm like, I'm writing a love story. What I'm not writing is erotica. That's not what I'm writing. Because I realized there are certain moments, the first moment they shake hands, that first moment of connection, the first kiss, these are important moments in a love story. But the moments that take place after that, and also to an extent, this was true of, let's say, her moment, her one night stand with the Andorian girl she meets in the club. Everything that happens after that and between the emotional aftermath the following morning, that belongs to them. That's their moment. That's their time. That's not for me. I don't get to be there. If I shouldn't have been there in the first place, I shouldn't be writing about it. So that's my thinking, was those moments are theirs. That's their private moment. What's important about the moment with the Andorian girl is that we were seeing that Seven is starting to understand the flirting process, but she's still mystified by part of it. And the more important part of that story was the emotional aftermath, coming to the other side of it and realizing I thought I was going to find a transcendental experience, and what I found was tawdry. I thought I was going to find connection, but actually I feel more alone now than I did yesterday. And so she's grappling with the paradox of, you know, we had this intimate moment, and yet why do I feel more alienated than ever? You know, what is going on here? And it's, you know, something that I think a lot of us deal with early in our life as we begin to navigate adult relationships. And then when it comes to her and Ellery, and they have that moment where they finally have that first kiss, and we can probably intuit what's going to follow. Well, I felt like any moment after that, I would feel like a voyeur. I'm like, any moment I feel like if telling the moment makes me feel like a voyeur, then it's going to feel skanky to a reader. I said, mm-hmm. any moment that even hints of voyeurism, out the airlock, bye-bye. So I'm like, mm-hmm. I want to tell a love story, but that's it. I don't want to intrude on their privacy. I want their privacy to be theirs. Yeah. So those were sort of the pitfalls I kept in mind. And I did play with one of them near the end of the book, where I'm like, the gay readers are going to think, Mac, you promised us no barrier gaze. You lied to me, didn't you? You're about to, and then I... You know, spoiler alert, there'll be the twist moment, and then you're gonna go, you didn't lie to me. Mm-hmm. All right, there we go.
Really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. There we go. My favorite moment of all of that was at the very end. I don't know how you feel about it, Jesse, but one of my favorite lines in the whole book is when Seven finally has Kogish on the floor, and he's trapped in, you know, a trap of his own making that's been sort of, you know, turned on him. And she basically just has to tell him, you know, I will never again be shamed for being who and what I am. And I will never let anyone tell me I don't know my own name.
I loved that moment, and I very much got the very overt queer trans vibes at that exact beat. And I was gonna connect. I felt it because again, it goes back to connecting to that bit where the Federation doesn't recognize her because of her name change.
Right.
And again, it goes to a lot of things that trans people have to deal with too. Of, oh, because our name on our documents doesn't match up, we exactly. don't get recognized, or there's always a pain in the ass.
Exactly. Yeah, you're have trouble opening a bank account.
Exactly. So at that moment was like, tell me I don't know my own name was a fantastic beat. And echoes too what happens in Picard season 3 with Shaw, where she's also put into another stage of transition in her life, joining Starfleet mm-hmm. and being like, do I fit mm-hmm. here now? And then facing that same stigma that she was facing that you bring up in this novel.
So of course, I think what's different there, obviously, I think Shaw is even aware that he's dead naming her, and he knows that he's being mm-hmm. a dick by doing it, but he's dealing with his repressed
trauma,
you know, Wolf 359 mm-hmm. and her connection to the Borg, which is what's triggering him. And he's just never dealt honestly with his own pain. He probably did not go to the Starfleet mandated counseling sessions that he was supposed to. And somehow it slipped through the cracks and he got away with it. But he really needed to go to those sessions. And he should.
You just gave me a thought. Is there like the like Starfleet corporate videos that people have to watch? Like, all right, everybody, time to watch the ex-Borg, the XB like corporate training video. How do you address ex-Borg's name? Don't stare at their cybernetic implants.
Okay, it's pronoun training day here at Starfleet.
Exactly.
I mean, we're going to be starting with the Andorians. They've got four genders. This gets a little confusing, so try to keep up. There will be a test.
Now, if they're in this type of relationship, here's all these pronouns. Yeah, that gosh, the HR department for Starfleet must be.
What is the proper way to ask out a Trill who has switched genders since you last knew them?
The answer is don't. It's a taboo in their society.
That's correct.
I love it. I love it. That would be very fun.
Oh my God! That's HR awesome. Training at Starfleet Academy intake. That's a comedy film waiting to be made.
That really is. I would love to make that one day.
Not to plant a bug in your ear, but I see a collab with you and Steve Shives in the. It, like I feel like that would be perfect.
That would actually be wonderful. He and I should do that with an HR. What is it like? Union rep Starfleet videos that he's did, and that those were fun. Yeah, I love those. He's killing it with those. So I should reach out to him. That would be a fun video to do.
Well, you briefly mentioned the framing story, which I want to address. And the story starts out with Seven of Nine meeting this stranger in a bar.
On Fenris.
On Fenris, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was sad that I actually recently rewatched season one. So there was the brief mention of like a tattoo on the temple. And I was like, oh, no, isn't it? And then, of course, you have to wait till the very end. But yes, it is, in fact, Bejazel. And it's the beginning of her worming her way into Seven of Nine's life and the beginning of the resultant havoc that creates. I'm curious what led you to kind of use that as the framing story and her part in Seven's life going forward.
The principal reason to have the framing sequence was that if we were just to do the story that's set in 2380, 2381 and leave it at that, as satisfying as that might've been as a story, we wouldn't have felt comfortable marketing that as a Star Trek Picard novel. Because although it tells a backstory event that is clearly related to and based on Picard, person who has watched Picard and picks up that book would feel like, I don't recognize any of the stuff in this book as being what I saw in Picard. Nothing I saw in Picard seems to have anything to do with the content of this book, aside from backstory. Whereas with the framing sequence, even though it's set still 13 to 15 years before Picard seasons 1 through 3, it is a scene at least that we remember her telling the story. And it's Seven now in her full kind of Ranger incarnation. She's like fully Ranger now, maybe still not quite as paranoid as she ought to be because she still has not suffered the great tragedy of her life yet. She hasn't lost her son Icheb yet. But we recognize her. This is, you know, the Ranger you see, Ranger Seven, with the beginnings of her alcoholism problem, you know, beginning with the whiskey as she's sitting at the bar. This is, you say, yeah, that's the Seven I remember seeing in Picard season one. There she is. How does she get this way? Well, she's telling the story, and she's telling the story to this stranger who has, you know, expressed a desire to join the Rangers, which, according to what she said in season one, is exactly how Bejazel approached her. A woman came up to me in a bar, said she wanted to be a Ranger. She basically gave us the story right there. And then the whole thing is, when you get to that last chapter, and she's sort of doing the wrap up, and there's the mention of, you know, she's saying, well, what happened? She's like, well, you know, the battle on Zerat, you know, the Omicron pulse, you know, permanently knocked out my Borg nanoprobes and my implants. You know, they're basically inert now. They're useless. This is a lie. She lies on purpose. She's learned to lie to protect herself. She gets careless. She knows to protect herself. She forgets to lie to protect Ichab. And she unwittingly puts a target on Ichab. The moment she starts talking about him and his capabilities and how wonderful he is and yada, 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 you might as well just kill him yourself. Because now Bejazel knows ex-Borg. She's got a name. She's got somebody to look for. She can now start putting the bounty out. And it's not long after that that she kills Ichab. Ichab is at that point in Starfleet. He is a serving officer. And it's while he's, you know, on an assignment cooperating with the Rangers, probably through something that Seven set up, that he stumbles into this trap and winds up getting butchered by Bejazel. The whole flashback sequence that we saw in season one of Picard. So this is right around that time. This is basically at most, maybe a few months at most before that tragedy happens. This is the conversation that will set in motion the greatest tragedy of Seven's life. And I felt like, you know, in terms of, you know, bookending a story, if you're going to bookend a story with anything, bookend it with something that's just as meaningful as the stuff inside.
And it gives a trajectory too of, again, just where her kind of arc goes into Picard, and then where she even goes into all the way through that series as well, of like, you see her leaving Starfleet and then finding her self identity, and then that also still being a place of transition. So I liked that like full circle of like, life's always a transition between many phases that you get with that. So
we're always going through changes.
And the universe does too.
So. Yeah. Change the essential nature of everything until it runs out of heat and entropy takes over. That's going to suck. Fortunately, we're not going to be here for that.
Well, speak for yourself. I plan to live forever.
Good luck with that one. I don't think you're going to enjoy entropy one bit. my only thought about death is, you know, the great irony of oblivion is you don't know it when you don't see it.
For me, I do have to say that, like, some of the most memorable things for me when I'm reading a book are those moments when you're reading and especially rereading something and you're screaming at the characters to make a different choice. And that moment at the end, at the very end of the bookend of this, where she's talking to Bejazel and getting closer, I'm screaming at Seven.
Don't buy her another drink. Get out of there.
Exactly.
What are you doing?
And that will stick with me. Like, that definitely, it's something that
It's meant to be that moment where, you know, just like her, this will be a moment that is going to haunt her for the rest of her life. She's going to realize that's the moment I got my son killed.
And it's also too, it speaks to one of the other, you were talking about pitfalls of straight writers often with queer characters. And what I did really like about this story, and with Bejazel sort of fitting into that, it's sort of alluded to in Picard, though never explicitly stated, is that you get a range of queer relationships here too, with the sort of more frivolous one that you talked about too with the Andorian, and then you get a more actual deep emotional love story, and then you get kind of an abusive exploitative one with Bejazel that is hinted at. And so it's often very easy to idolize queer relationships in stories, especially those by even well-meaning straight writers. And so this was like a nice range of, like, here's, you know, queer people's relationships are just as, can be just as beautiful and just as messed up as straight people's relationships. And I did like that panoply of relationships that we get here.
Thank you. I also wanted to make sure that there were characters who were just part of the universe, like Deputy Chief Yiv, who was described as being intersex, and it's just, that's just a fact of their existence, and it's there, and we move on. We have Lieutenant Darusha, the aide to Admiral Janeway, who is described essentially with non-binary pronouns, a non-binary individual. And again, it's simply there. It is acknowledged. Yes, here it is. And then nothing more need be said because it is a normal part of the landscape. Here it is. Yes, we acknowledge this is what it is, and we move on.
It's what I've loved about the novel so much. I mean, the shows have been doing it pretty well too, but even then, there's also even there's it also has to fit into the apparatus of like Picard. There was like a non-binary ensign, and I'm glad for that. And it's important to celebrate that too. But it's always sort of like the there's always that little bit of like, hey, we're celebrating. Look, we have the non-binary characters. Like, I also just like it being like, yeah, there's just a character that happens to be there that's non-binary. We're never going to draw attention to it. Which it's again, there's all things for their own way, but I always appreciate seeing that in a novel of just like, hey, yeah, it's a non-binary character, no bigger deal to it. So
one last thing that I kind of wanted to bring up was the audiobook version of this, and Jesse, that's how I listened to it.
Yep.
So what was that experience like? I know all of the Star Trek novels lately have been getting this audiobook treatment. I personally haven't experienced that myself, but January Lavoie, I know, has been getting some rave reviews online for her narration of this book. What was that experience like?
I loved it. I mean, Jennifer, both her and I'm blanking on the gentleman who does the sort of male focused
Robert Petcoff.
Both of them are fantastic, but Jennifer, like, her Janeway is spot on. Like, it is a perfect Janeway impression. And then everyone else was also really, really great too. And she just does a great job sort of capturing the essence of each character so that, you know, she's not doing like her Seven is not exactly Jeri Ryan, but you can still get the essence of that character's defiance and also like her stiltedness towards the beginning and then her opening up towards later on. That's what I really love in a good audio narrator is they are able to like capture the essence of a character while not being too distracting from the audiobook, because, you know, they're there to read the book as opposed to like it being like an audio drama, for example.
Right.
So I think that that's a really good skill, and she does a great job. And then also shout out to Robert Petcoff, who also does great too. His I will say Robert Petcoff's Vulcan characters are always phenomenal whenever he reads. His Vulcans are fantastic.
So I guess, David, from your perspective, is there anything different that goes into when you know it's going to be an audiobook or anything like that, or...
Well, I mean, over the last few years, audiobooks have become sort of standard operating practice for the Trek novels. Mm-hmm. Going back now at least 6 years, maybe more. I can't really remember when it became just something that we could count on happening with all the books in a given cycle. In the years since that has become de rigueur, I have modified my writing style a little bit to the point where I used to use, you know, noun markers like said, he said, she said, whatever, very sparingly. Now I try to use them not at all. Mm-hmm. I have tried to adopt a style that indicates a shift in speaker by incorporating maybe mentioning somebody's mood, a shift in expression, doing something that cues the reader to understand our focus is now on this character, and then immediately attaching their line of dialogue to whatever that bit of description is. So that as a result, when you're listening to the audiobook and the audio reader, the narrator, is able to go through, they know that they have to shift to that voice, and they can read the dialogue and then come out of the dialogue back into pure exposition without the clumsiness of having to read the words he said. Because I felt like he said, although it is invisible, they say, you know, when you're reading it in printed prose, when I was listening to it in audio format, it made me just sort of bristle every time. Every time I heard it, I felt like it was jumping out at me. Like, in an audio format, it's not invisible. There is nothing invisible right. In audio format. Every word that's read registers. So it doesn't just slip by the way it does when your eye is scanning the page and you know to just skim over he said, she said. So because I was aware of this particular fact about audiobooks over the last several years, if you look, you'll see there was a shift probably going anywhere from 6 to 8 years ago. You'll see the shift happen in my prose where I just begin to jettison almost all use of dialogue markers. I just jettison them to the point where I don't even use them anymore for the most part.
It's interesting too, because I notice I do a lot of, for my own work, because I do YouTube stuff, like I write all my videos, but then I'll read them and it's like, oh, this looks great. And then I will say them out loud and I'll be like, oh man, this feels awkward to say. Because as you read them, it'll be like, oh, I can have this long sentence. It makes sense. There's a lot of, they all connect very well. But when you say them, it feels very mash. I can't say as I'm doing right now with my sentences. I'm very articulate. it just sort of like runs all together and it doesn't complete an idea and it sort of becomes noise. So it's interesting to hear other authors like discuss what's the difference between having just written it and then hearing it read aloud. So
yeah, one of the things I do during the editing process is read the book out loud to myself while I'm working on it. I find that that often helps me find missing words, omitted words. It also helps me find homonyms that I've messed up. Things jump out at me more clearly when I'm reading the book out loud. The other thing I find when I read it out loud is if a sentence just doesn't roll off the tongue, if it doesn't work, if it's clumsy, if there are two words that have been placed together, which while they look fine in print, when you try to speak them, your tongue just does not navigate well, and it causes the reader to stumble verbally. When I find those, I try to take them out and rewrite them into something that flows more lyrically. And I try to be aware of the musicality of text, the rhythm, the pace. Does the sentence, do sentences get shorter as the action gets faster? Do I hit hard enough? Does it make the right point? If I'm going to have a long, eloquent sentence, do I at least find a variety of different words? Do I find that there's a nice sort of assonance to it? Do I work in a little sort of subtle rhyme before I wrap it up? I look for ways in which the music of the language can come through. And I also look for the traps where it doesn't work. Reading it out loud as part of the editing process helps with that.
I'm reminded of every time I put the phrase edited it into one of my YouTube scripts. I'm like, no, can't do that.
Yep.
Awesome. No, that's a really cool insight. And I never thought of that shift as the audiobook thing comes in. That's really cool. I guess to wrap up, I just have to say, I absolutely love this novel. I think it speaks to a lot of really great things. And again, just going back to that desire to see that backstory, 4 years ago now, I can't believe it's been that long, but to finally see the start of that, I can't imagine that it'll, light the same kind of fire, like I said, that it would for, a Pike series or Star Trek Legacy. But like, come on, give us a Fenris Rangers limited run, even just showing us stuff that's centered not just on Starfleet and stuff. I loved it just for that, too.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed doing it, obviously. I don't know that I want to do another Fenris Rangers book, but if they came to me and said, hey, this thing sold really well, we want you to write another, I'm not a fool. I'll say yes. I'll find a reason. I'll find a story worth telling. But I think what really intrigued me about this one is that it's a standalone, and very often over the last 20 years, we were doing all this interconnected continuity. So to get back to sort of the old classic way of the Star Trek novels, the way they were back in like the 80s and the 90s, where each one was this standalone event, this experience, and to have it be the coming of age story for Seven, a beloved character, that was just a really exciting project to take on. But for me, the most harrowing part was just waiting to find out whether or not queer and trans readers felt like I accomplished my mission. Did I achieve representation with respect and authenticity? And did it work as a story for them? And that's my hope, is that I wanted there to be good representation in a Star Trek story so that everybody, especially people who feel like maybe they have not been well represented in the past, can see themselves as part of Star Trek's bright future and say, see, I belong there too. There's me.
I can't speak for everyone, but for myself, what I will say is the queer aspect of it, the literal queer aspect of it, I really love, and I thought you captured very well. And the trans metaphor that Seven fits within also works very, very well. And again, that moment of like, say, like, know my damn name, I thought was a great sort of like, not even just a, like, haha, look at the trans metaphor, there it is. It was a great triumphant moment for her character and fit her arc. And oftentimes when I see those types of stories, it usually will be like, hey, look, we are doing the trans metaphor now. Whereas here is it felt just a natural outgrowth of the story that you were telling that is very queer in its ethos, but wasn't very much like pointing and saying, look, we're doing the queer stuff now. So I thought you did a really excellent job from my perspective. So
thank you. It means a lot.
Well, I guess all that's left is to ask what you have on the go, what you can talk about, can't talk about, Star Trek or otherwise, that our listeners would be interested in.
Well, let's see. Don't have any novels currently under contract, unfortunately. I have an original that I'm tinkering with, but it's not ready to go out into the world to look for a home yet. I have 4 Star Trek short stories coming up over the course of this year in Star Trek Explorer magazine. And that's going to be in 4 consecutive issues, 11, 12, 13, and 14. The one in 11 I know will be in the print edition. The others might be in the print or they might be in the digital supplement. So you might want to subscribe now so you don't miss anything. I'm just saying. But I'm very happy with those 4 short stories. They were fun to write. They're, I'd like to say they're all very different, but actually the first 3 are all in some way ruminations on death and grief and loss. And then the 4th one is just an ass-kicking action story. So I had some fun with that. I have 2...
all the best parts of David Mack there, honestly.
Lots of grief, death, and introspection followed by somebody getting their ass handed to them. Yeah. That's me.
How life should go.
And then I've got 2 original short stories coming out in themed anthologies. One is coming out in November, and the other, I think, is scheduled for the fall, but I don't have a firm date for that yet. One is from Bane, and that's going to be The Last Train to Kepler 283C. Space Western is the theme of the anthology. And my story in that one is called Living by the Sword. And it's basically a young girl dreams of adventure until an encounter with an old female gunfighter encourages her to take a different path in life. And then the other story is part of an anthology called Combat Monsters, edited by Henry Hertz. And that anthology is basically real battles of World War II reimagined if they involve supernatural creatures, monsters, creatures out of myth, whatever. So my story is called Boxcar, B-O-C-K-S-C-A-R, which is the name of the real life aircraft that dropped the second atomic bomb on Nagasaki. You can imagine what kind of monster they're going to face. So that's what I have coming out in terms of fiction. In nonfiction, coming around the end of April, there is a book called Strange Novel Worlds, Essays on Star Trek Fiction. It has an essay by me. I'm actually the first one in the book, called Official But Not Canon. And it's basically about writing Star Trek tie-ins as a professional and how what I need to know about things like canon, continuity, and how these terms are not necessarily synonymous. There's also an essay in there by Una McCormick, and essays by a number of other tremendous fan writers. So it's basically a deep dive look into different aspects of Star Trek fiction, most of it the official published fiction. There may be some essays on fan fiction, I'm not sure. I'd have to have another look at the TOC. But that's,
what's that one called?
It's called Strange Novel Worlds. And it's coming from McFarland Books. They publish mostly academic books, of which this is an academic book. It's a work of academic essays. So it's my first time doing academic writing since college. So it's been about 30 years. But there it is. And that's coming out in April. Not a cheap book, but by academic book standards, it is pretty affordable. It's like $55, I think, is the cover price.
I just pre-ordered it while you were talking. It is $55, and it's coming out on April 29th. So there you go.
Nice.
There you go. So that's what I have in the pipeline that I know of. I'm currently working on a top secret scripting gig that I can't really talk about because I don't know what the final credits on it are going to be and whether my contribution is going to be anonymous or not. So I'll find that out in a few months. And I'm hoping to get another Trek book one of these years. We'll see.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely, of course, be reading it. So
I can only hope.
Awesome. And if people want to follow you or catch up on what you've got coming up, where can they do that?
Well, you can rely on me to have my bibliography updated on my official website, davidmack.pro. That's David Mack, M-A-C-K, davidmack.pro. You can find me on Blue Sky at David Mack, all one word, lowercase. I'm also on Facebook. I have an author page at facebook.com/TheDavidMack. And there are others besides that, but those are the ones I principally use.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really, really appreciate it. And Jesse, thank you so much for co-hosting.
Of course, yes.
I really appreciate you and the perspective you bring and having you on the show as always. Why don't you take some time here and share with our listeners what you've got going on, because you've got a lot going on right now and I'm really excited about all of it.
Well, that's my, where you can follow me for the most part is Jesse Gender on YouTube. That's where my video essay style stuff is. I have a lot of video essays on Star Trek for all of y'all. And then you can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky are the main ones, Jesse Gender as well. But yeah, what you're alluding to is I'm working on a science fiction film starring John DeLancey is going to be in it. And he was amazing. I actually have a voiceover recording session with him next Friday, so I'm going to be talking with him, and he's literally the sweetest and one of the nicest people. He's been super wonderful about speaking of like queer and trans stuff. Like, our set was super queer and super trans. We had trans flags everywhere and we had pronoun buttons all over the set, and he came in and he was just like, oh, and he was super kind and got everyone's pronouns right off the bat, and he was like super like on it and just excited to be there. So like, nice. Just like, he very easily could have been just like, oh, I'm here, I'm gonna do it my day and get out of here, but he was super kind, so he's wonderful. And the rest of the movie is super queer, super trans. We have John DeLancey is the only cis straight white dude on the whole cast, and I share him because he's the Star Trek person, but Abigail Thorne of Philosophy Tube, and Jackie Cox, who everyone knows from RuPaul's Drag Race, Jessica Nicole from Fringe. So I'm very pumped about it. It'll be coming out later this year. I know the official, what the planned official release date is, but I can't say just yet. But it'll be coming in just a few short months, hopefully, for everybody over on Nebula. So that's the streaming service that's funding it. So I am very pumped about it. So thank you for indulging me sharing all that, but it's going to be fun. So.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I'm excited too. It's looks to be really cool. I can't wait. And every time you bring it up, I keep forgetting, like, Jessica Nicole, I love her.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many awesome people.
She's everyone. I was, you know, for a first project, everyone on this film was just the absolute sweetest, I guess. And like, most of our cast and crew was all, like I said, queer, trans and women. So it was just a very queer set that everyone was just having fun on, and the vibes were always very nice. So I was very lucky just by everyone in the cast and crew just being kick-ass. So
awesome. Well, I'll definitely have a link to all of that in the show notes for this as well, so go check that out if you haven't yet. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again so much. This has been great. We will see you next time on the next Positively Trek. Until then, as always, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.